For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and today's show is a stand-up comedian special featuring Robin Ince, Joe Brand, Phil Jupitus, Susan Kalman, Tony Hawks, and Michael Palin. Now, today's first guest on this special Read On is comedian Robin Ince. Because we mention it at the start and to give this interview some context, the last time I spoke to Robin was about his book, The Bad Book Club.
I should say, even though it's called Bad Books, I fought against that because I think they're books that are wonderfully different. And some of them are bad as well, but some of them are just, they are in the arena of the peculiar.
The book's a collection of articles about Bad Mills and Boone, remarkable autobiographies of people like Sid Little and Don Estelle, a whole series of books about killer crabs, and a memorable one called How to Pick Up Sexy Girls.
Well, The Secret of Picking Up Sexy Girls was a book that I found in Scotland, in fact. I found it in Aberdeen, as far as I remember. And it's just this incredible book written in 1975, which tells you, first of all, where to meet sexy girls, which can be anywhere from a discotheque to perhaps a conservatory or municipal garden. Then it shows how to impress them by perhaps knowing the Latin name of a flower. And then it tells you how to take their clothes off. And it covers everything from hat to tights. So each one has its own paragraph.
Now, as a connoisseur of comedy, Robin Ince has spent decades mining your eccentricities to create gags and watching other strange individuals do the same. And for years on The Infinite Monkey Cage with Brian Cox, he sought, sometimes in vain, to understand the world around us. In the book that he'll be talking about in a moment, he unties these pursuits to tackle some of the biggest questions that intrigue us all. Why do we make the choices we do in life? Where does anxiety come from? Informed by interviews with a bevy of A-list comedians from Joe Brand and Tim Minchin to Ricky Gervais, as well as with neuroscientists, psychologists and doctors, this is a hilarious and often profound primer to the mind. I'm joined at the Wigtown Book Festival by Robin Ince. Is this your first time in Wigtown?
No, I was here 4 years ago talking about what we talked about last time, I think, which is my favourite giant killer crab novels. And also had a horror book out then called Dead Funny. So we also talked about how we'd done a comedy book of horror stories. By comedians, and people had thought they were going to be funny, but actually comedians were going, oh good, I can allow my darkest thoughts out and place them in this particular cellar.
We also talked about how to pick up sexy girls as well.
That's right, I had this book called The Secret of Picking Up Sexy Girls and different advice on how to remove cardigans. It was a sordid affair, but it may well explain much of what's happened since.
Now, what book are you here with today?
It's a new one called I'm a Joke and So Are You, and it's basically the story of looking at comedians and seeing what we can learn about all human beings by looking at some of the traits that are most well known about comedians. So it's talking about it's talking sometimes about melancholy, it's talking about social anxiety, it's talking about creativity, it's talking about inner voices, how some people turn their inner voices into ventriloquist acts. Nina Conti, for instance. So I was fascinated to find out that Nina's I always used to think ventriloquists would sometimes look at their dummy and go, I can't believe my dummy's saying that. But actually, it turns out they spend the rest of their life going, I can't believe I'm not saying that. At last, I have the sock on my hand and now it can be released. So, and also why we become the human beings we become. You know, there's so many legends about, you know, comedians, why, what might have happened in their childhood that led them to being desperate to be funny. And so it's kind of, yeah, talking about those things and whether they can be used as a way. Generally, there's so many comics now who do very interesting shows that can be very, very personal. And when they do those shows, I think they're very helpful to an audience as well. They are those shows where people go, oh, someone has said aloud what I've kept hidden. And so a lot of comedy now also, I think, is an act of sometimes giving people permission.
That rung true, actually, about the hyper-awareness of your inner voice, because during this interview, you know, my inner monologue is saying, don't forget your next question, are you looking in the right place, you know, and that was liberating hearing someone else saying that.
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, I didn't, some people do have moments of quietness, but if my inner voice shuts up, I then go, hang on, what happened in the last minute? I don't know what was going on. My homunculus went quiet.
Now, we have in the library your book, How to Build a Universe, and it's got an unusual introduction. Not many books phone a python to introduce it.
Anyway, so we'll start the Monkage book with a beginning, and we have a very special forward. And you got Eric Idle to write this, didn't you?
Yeah, we're very good friend. I think, actually, if I ring him up, I think he'll do it. Well, he will do it. He'll do it for me.
Okay, well, that's been great. Great to have Eric Idle at the beginning of the book. Yeah.
Right. I'll turn it off touch tone so that people can't work out his number.
Yeah.
Hello? Hello, Eric?
Hello?
Is that Eric?
Who's this?
It's Brian. Brian
who? Brian
Cox.
You're the actor?
Oh, no, I'm the other one.
Oh, the other one. How's that going?
It's going very well indeed. It's going. I'm finding out new secrets of the universe as we speak.
But and you can never keep them. That's the thing about you, isn't it?
Yeah. Listen, Eric, yes. We're recording the audiobook for The Infinite Monkage, How to Build a Universe, and you were kind enough to write an introduction. Would it be possible for you to read your introduction for the audiobook?
That's not an introduction, that's a warning. I don't want people being seduced into buying this book just because they have my dulcet tones on the recording.
Oh, right. Well, so the answer's a no, then.
Well, anyway, good luck with the whole book enterprise thing, you know. We started that Christmas book, I did, actually, in about 1969 or 70, with Monty Python's Big Red Book, and a jolly good thing it was, too, because we sold thousands of copies to the unsuspecting British public.
Is it still available?
No.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun we had, because Eric Idle has been on the show a few times, and so we asked Eric if he'd write us. Of course, as usually wrote an introduction that was just him explaining that he wasn't making off enough money and all those kind of things. And then when we went into the studio to record the book, I said to Brian, should we just ring Eric? So we did, out of the blue, we basically rang Eric. What do you want? No. Is there any more money in this? Ridiculous. And that was, and it's, those are those moments where you go, this is surreal, where, you know, to sit next to Eric on those shows and to have our theme song having been created by Eric Idle and Jeff Lynne. And then you go, that's Eric Idle and Jeff Lynne. Eric Idle, you know, one of the greatest, one of the strongest laughs we've ever had. One of those moments where ice cream came out of my nose was the first time I watched The Ruttles, All You Need Is Cash, you know, and Life for Brian. It's, yeah, brilliant.
Now, the show, The Infinite Monkage, your role essentially is on behalf of the listeners to say, wait, what?
Yeah, I'm actually not allowed to become clever in any way because it will affect my career. So every time I think maybe I should become wiser, I think, hang on a minute, if I become as wise as Brian Cox, then I become redundant. So I'll have to remain the idiot that I am. But that's what, you know, what we're trying to do as much as possible with The Infinite Monkage is just introduce ideas to people. It's sometimes I know that we will have moments which may become quite difficult and we don't shy away from those. But at the same time, what we want to do is get seven-year-olds, or, well, I suppose we have quite a lot of nine-year-olds who listen to the show, and very often they listen with their grandmother. And there's a lovely thing of getting letters from people who are 90 and people who are nine, because what we want to do is not go, here's all the information you need. What we want to do is go, here's enough information to make you very excited about this idea and hopefully rush off and, you know, read or listen to a book based around these ideas.
Is there an audio version of the new book on its way?
The new one will be available as soon as I've sat in the studio for Audible, so there will definitely be an audio version of I'm a Joke and So Are You.
How do you find recording books?
I love it, but I read Tim Peake's book for the audio version of that, and my God, did I mispronounce an enormous number of Russian names. And afterwards I said to Tim Peake, I said, I'm really sorry, Tim, but I think I said a few of the landing areas, I said them very... He said, no, well, that's probably how I'd have said them as well. So in the end, there was accidental authenticity in my ineptitude. But it is... But I love doing that. And I think with I'm a Joke, like we did with How to Build a Universe, I won't just read the book. Mm. And also Stuart Lee, who did the introduction, saying, you know, I have to do Stuart's voice, and that is quite an acerbic introduction that you wrote for me.
Robin Ince, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Growing up in the 1970s and 1980s, our interest in space, technology and strange undersea creatures with terrifying tentacles, or the ability to eat their own brains, came from a mixture of Look and Learn magazine, The $6 Million Man and Arthur C. Clarke's Mysterious World.
We were kids in the Indian summer of the space race, a little too young to remember the moon landings, but the excitement of exploration still enthused us all. I, myself, still own a Space 1999 outfit.
Well, you say still, you've had it specially made. Three of them.
Recently.
Mm.
Yeah. It was a time of Cold War danger and anxiety, but also of immense optimism and confidence in the promise of science and technology.
I think it says a lot that you've got a Space 99 outfit and I've got a Blake
Space 99.
Space 99, yeah. I've got my version of the moon just has a flake sticking out of it. That's the entire thing. All that happened was a small piece of chocolate was jettisoned off the moon.
You know, less ambitious, but still.
Yeah, more delicious. Yeah. There's not enough chocolate in Space 1999. Yeah, I've got a Blake 7 outfit, which is just like a bit of a sheep.
Flake 7.
Flake 7. Oh, we should rewrite this book. It's too late now, isn't it? Now we've found the puns.
How to Build a Universe by Professor Brian Cox and Robin Ince is TB702311. I'm a Joke, and So Are You will be available in audio as soon as Robin records it.
Robin Ince there, with them added Brian Cox and Eric Idle. And we'll have another Python popping up in the show later on. I'm a Joke, So Are You, Reflections on Humour and Humanity has now been recorded and is available on audio, as is Robin's newest book, The Importance of Being Interested. You're listening to a special stand-up comedy edition of Read On, listening back to some of the comedians who've appeared on the show. And next up...
Comedian Susan Kalman escaped corporate law in 2006 to become a stand-up. She's now a regular on radio and television panel shows like QI, The News Quiz, Sorry I Haven't a Clue, and recently on Strictly Come Dancing. Cheer up, love. Susan's first book had a clear aim: to help people understand depression. Her new book, Sunny Side Up, has a similarly clear path: to persuade people to be kinder.
Every time I don't get a job or I watch a television panel show that I've been rejected for, I remember the saying and wait for the fates to decide my role in life. If it's right, it'll happen. Hopefully. Without getting all spiritual on you this early in the book, I truly believe that although we're all very much in control of our own destiny, that we can often make things happen through sheer determination. Sometimes, for no discernible reason, we're given a nudge in the right direction. Whether it be dancing on the television as Wonder Woman, or a chance encounter in a car park, sometimes things simply must happen. And they often happen to me.
This time 2 years ago, you were telling everybody to tell you that your talk was awful. Why was that?
Oh, no, that's right, because I don't like compliments. I have changed since then, though, you see. That's the point of the second book, is that first book was quite unkind about myself. I wrote it, but this is about kindness and joy, so it's about being kinder to yourself. So I'm a changed woman.
So it's a kind of antithesis sequel.
Yeah, it's the sequel where a lot of things change. You know, a lot's happened in the 2 years since I wrote it. It's just about kindness and joy and happiness and trying to be positive.
I was at the supermarket in Glasgow a year or so ago. My wife and I had finished our weekly shop, loaded the car up with cat food, beetroot and macaroni. We have a very interesting diet. And set off for home. As we turned the corner to exit the car park, we saw an older woman. I won't use the term elderly, as that should only be used to describe trees, not people, who was resting against the boot of her car. She wasn't distressed or upset, she just looked tired. All we were about to do was go home and play Assassin's Creed, so we stopped the car to see how she was. Turned out she was fine, but she was indeed tired, so we offered to do her shopping for her. After a lot of objections, we did what any sensible person would do and bundled her into her car to wait for us. I mean, it probably looked slightly suspicious from afar, but we were all having fun. We bought her shopping, a bunch of flowers, wouldn't accept her money, made sure she was safely in her car, and she drove off. A few weeks later, my agent got an email from that lady's friend. She'd considered writing to the Sunday Post, a Scottish newspaper, to try and contact me, she said, but decided to try the internet instead. The lady we'd helped was 92 and still going strong. She and her friends played bridge together every month, and as I corresponded with her pal, I learned a bit about their lives and their stories. I asked for their addresses and I started to send them postcards from my travels. As time progressed, they would send me updates of how they thought I was doing on Strictly, and I would give them some gossip from behind the scenes. Christmas greetings followed, and in a spell of bad weather, I contacted them to check they were okay and asked if they needed help with anything. In return, I was told of family members' achievements and interesting books to read or music to listen to. I tell you that story because it's so very simple. From that one act of kindness, I have a group of friends who I would never have met in any other way. and that fills my heart with joy every day. Over the past few years, I've changed my life. I've gone from being miserable in the shadows to walking in the sunshine. I've most definitely turned my life sunny side up. So if I'm asked to describe this book, I do know what to say. It's about two of the best things in the world, kindness and joy. And I, possibly the grumpiest woman in the world, I'm going to try and tell you why you need more of them in your life. Because I don't know about you, but I love a challenge.
Now, on your tour, you were asking people to tweet you about acts of kindness that they experienced. What were some of those?
Oh, there were lots of acts of kindness, from ones you would expect, like people helping with car parking or people helping people into cars or trains. But there were also some really lovely ones about just being mindful of people. You know, a postman helped save a hedgehog, and somebody giving someone else a handkerchief when they were crying in a cafe, and just moments where you spend time to look at another human being and think about them and be kind to them.
So what's the message of Sunny Side Up, and what message would you give to the listeners?
The message really is to try and be kinder and to embrace joy wherever you find it. Mm-hmm. And the message to the listeners really is, it really is, I think, that you can take pleasure in really small things and to enjoy them and to try and be happy. The world can be quite an awful place sometimes, but trying to be happy is a good thing.
And if someone's experiencing joy, just let them.
Absolutely. The worst thing you can do is try and bring someone down just because you're not happy at that point. So if someone's happy, let them be happy, because it's a lovely thing.
Sunny Side Up, narrated by Susan Calman herself, is available commercially now.
You're listening to a Read On Comedian special, and from one Radio 4 regular to another. A huge supporter of Talking Books is the actor, comedian and author Tony Hawks, and his book, Playing the Moldovans at Tennis, has recently not only entered the Talking Books library, but it's now also a movie.
I have to beat the entire Moldovan national football team at tennis, one by one.
You are very optimistic.
It's always a good idea to have a visual picture of what your challenge is.
This is the list of the players that you need to play.
Sounds easy. Should be out of here within the week.
У меня нет времени заниматься вашими глупостями.
Kei voibate la tennis pototi din equipa nazionale di football. Vriti za jukati kumine.
Я не говорю по-английски.
What did he say?
He said that he doesn't speak English.
You want to play Oleg Shishkin at tennis?
Yes.
And Tony Hawks joins me now. Now, this was your second book, and as with Round Ireland with a Fridge, it started as a bet.
It did, yeah. It's a bizarre story, really. We were watching England play Moldova in the World Cup qualifiers on the TV, myself and my friend Arthur Smith. I'd been playing tennis, so I was sitting there in tennis kit. Out of the blue, he just said, "I don't reckon you're that good at tennis, Tony. I don't reckon you could beat. I don't reckon you could beat all those footballers we're watching." And I said, "I thought I could, because footballers aren't known for being very good at tennis." And we got into a genuine argument about this. And he said, "Look, I bet you couldn't beat them." And I said, "It's a silly bet. I'd never be able to play the England players. They'd never agree to play me. They got managers, agents. I'd never be able to reach them." He said, "All right, I bet you couldn't beat the entire Moldovan team. They won't have managers and agents. And what's more, if you do beat them, I'll strip naked on Balamai Road and sing the Moldovan national anthem." And so I thought, well, this sounds like an adventure. I think I was probably... I'd done Round Island with a Fridge. I'd had an amazing time. It was a very interesting thing to go off and do something quite wacky and silly. And this appealed to me, you know, the idea of going to a country I knew nothing about. We had to look it up on the map to see where it was. And then and go with this challenge, you know, to track down the 11 footballers that had played in this match and ask them to play me at tennis. And the adventure began like that.
Now, to find out if you did it or not, you're going to have to listen to the book. But Arthur Smith, I believe, laid some traps for you along the way.
Yes, it wasn't all as his behaviour lacked dignity, one might say. Without giving too much away, after a very, very sticky start, things started to go better. And then there was a certain amount of subterfuge that took place, and I don't want to say too much, because as you mentioned, it can spoil it. But You'll have to listen to find out what it is that happens.
Now, at the start of this journey, did you think it would have such a philanthropic effect on you, which is lasting to this day?
Not at all, no. I mean, I went there, you know, hoping to have a big adventure, fun adventure, and write a book about it. I did, unlike Round Island with the Fridge, where I just went on this sort of whim and the story emerged, it became a book. This one I was commissioned by publishers, and so it was almost like my job for that period of time to go and track down footballers. But when I got there, I ended up with a sort of moral dilemma, because Moldova was then and is still the poorest country in Europe. I saw a lot of poverty, I saw a lot of people suffering, and I felt like the people I'd stayed with, the two doctors who were lovely people, hadn't been paid for 6 months. People were sitting on the streets selling things like, you know, one item of clothing or just a fish that they'd caught. And I hadn't really been close, particularly in Europe, to that kind of poverty. And I thought, God, this is difficult because, you know, what am I doing? I'm swanning in here as this relatively super rich Westerner. I'm going to get my story and I'm going to go back to UK and profit from it. So I made a decision, you know, almost thinking, well, that there's only one way to make this fair, and that would be to share whatever royalties I get with Moldova in some way. So all the royalties from the book have always gone into a fund, and it's been split 50-50 between me and a trust fund for Moldova. And fortunately, the book did well enough for us to buy a property. I went back to the doctors and said, look, I've got this money, what can we do with it? And they said, well, we need to open a centre for kids with cerebral palsy. We get them all referred to us and we can't do anything for them. And the state at that time just said, you've got to put them in a home. We'd like these families to be able to keep their children. So we set up this care centre, and it's been going on for 10 years now. I've made a film, and we're going to give the profits of that, all the profits of that, to this care centre. So it's an ongoing thing.
One thing I wondered about the film, why did Arthur Smith become Stephen Frost?
Very good point. Well, Arthur, I don't know whether you've met him or know him, but he certainly appeared a few times on a programme called Grumpy Old Men. And he's got really good at it. And I phoned him up and asked him if he'd like to play himself in the film. And I got him on a morning when he was particularly grumpy. And he said, I can't be bothered, Hawks. I've too much on my plate. Can you get someone else? I can't be bothered. He just couldn't be bothered, really. I think he'd had a bad... But whether if I'd chased him and really pushed him, he would have done it. I think I probably could have persuaded him. But it was a project where I thought, well, if you don't want to do it, don't do it. I don't want to sort of have to bully you. And I rang Steve, and he's from the same era, Stephen Frost. You know, he's an old mate of mine, and he's almost the kind of guy that would have done that. He was a fantastic substitute for Arthur. It was a great shame he didn't do it, but he also hasn't done a lot of acting, and although he's a fantastic comedian, Steve's done a lot more acting, and it may well have been that he didn't want to take that on either.
And not saying who, but is there any nudity at the end?
Aha, there is, but we have carefully shot it. It's mostly shot from it's shot from the rear, and
as it were,
it's carefully done. It's tastefully done. Yeah.
Playing the Moldovans at Tennis and many more books from Tony Hawkes are available from RNIB Talking Books, and of course wherever books are sold. For more information, head to www.rnib.org.uk.
RNIB Library has all the latest reading titles in a format that suits your needs. You choose the books, you choose the format, we deliver to your door. Follow us on Twitter at RNIB Library or find us on Facebook.
A huge supporter of RNIB is author, traveller and Python, Michael Palin.
Day 1, 25th of September, 1988. I leave the Reform Club, Pall Mall, London, 115 years, 356 days, 10 and three-quarter hours after Phileas Fogg. It's a wet, stuffy morning. I've had 3.5 hours sleep, and the only thing I envy Phileas is that he's fictional.
A clip from 80 Days Around the World, which kicked off Michael Palin's unexpected second career, and it's also the starting point for his book Travelling to Work, a third volume of diaries, which also chronicles the success of the film A Fish Called Wanda, the birth of travel shows Pole to Pole and Full Circle, and much, much more. I spoke to Michael Palin in the King's Theatre in Edinburgh just before his one-man show and asked him if, after all these years, he still got nervous.
Yeah, I always get nervous. I mean, you've got to, really. I think the times when I think I'm not nervous are always the worst, because I go into it and I just feel nice and relaxed. I remember the last of the Monty Python shows at the O2. It was, despite a lot of pressure, because it was being filmed all over the world, sent out to cinemas, it was lovely. I was really nice and relaxed, really, really enjoying it. And there's one particular rather complicated line I had to do. And I took pride in the fact that I always got it right, all the time. On this particular night, it was coming up, and I thought, hey, what do I say now? Where's this going? And I guess I made something up to patch my way through it. But that was a wake-up call. I said, come on, Palin, get nervous. Don't be smug. And it is a fact that I think that's just energy coming into your body, the old adrenaline working. I've come to terms with it.
What was the line?
it was in the Protestant sketch, because we're Protestants who successfully challenged the supreme power of the papacy in the early 16th century. We can wear little rubber things on the end of one of these, to prevent issue. Yes,
That was quite nice reading. Travelling to Work, when you were actually nervous about doing your interviews at the start.
Well, I was a comedian. I'd done acting. I could do comedy and all that sort of thing. But this was something I wasn't quite sure what they required me to be as a traveller. Yeah, was I to be pretending to be Phileas Fogg? So was I acting? Or was I just me, Michael Palin? In which case, what on earth would I talk about that would be of any interest to anybody? Or was I going to be a presenter, reporter with a microphone, asking people questions about their country and all that? And we hadn't worked this out. Mm-hmm. And so at the beginning, I suddenly became aware that I really wasn't sure if I could, what I could deliver. Mm-hmm. And when I did interviews to start with, we tended to do quite set-up interviews, and they weren't always with people I particularly wanted to talk to. And so we'd go through it, and it would be quite dull, because I wasn't really terribly interested, to be honest. What happened after the third of the third episode, when we were on a dhow going across from Dubai to Bombay, we were with 18 Gujarati fishermen, Indian guys, just on a dhow. They didn't know any English, and we depended absolutely on their expertise and their navigation to get us from place to place. And we all slept on deck together. They cooked us food, and we suddenly I got little relationships forged with these guys who I'd never normally speak to at all. And by the time we finished that journey, I realised the best thing was just to be as natural as possible, to show what I could do, which was a genuinely inquiring, inquisitive nature, and make some of the interviews just encounters. You didn't have to talk to the Prime Minister. You don't have to talk to the head of this or that. Just the people you meet along the way. Make contact. Have encounters. And you learn a lot about different people in different ways of life. So then I relaxed and I said, I'm just going to be me, curious me, going around the world. And it kind of worked out.
And yet it's reduced to a footnote in the book, I noticed.
A lot has been said about Around the World in 80 Days, and I've written a book based on all my experiences. That was published back in 1989. So I didn't want to go over that ground yet again in the diaries. So in the diaries, you see, I've got some of the private diaries that I kept, personal diaries that I've never been seen before, and a few of those, but they don't cover much of the journey. And then it really starts when I come back and you get back to life and suddenly there's lots going on. And this great journey, which you've just done, is, you know, it's one of three or four other projects. I have to start writing the book straight away. And, of course, what I have to remember is that I wasn't expecting to do any more travel series at all. This was entirely a one-off. I didn't even know how it was going to work. So I had to make sure that I had other balls in the air and other things to go back to. So that's perhaps why it seems less enormous and significant.
Was there a resistance to edit with the benefit of hindsight?
Yeah, I mean, I had to edit. It was a colossal amount. I mean, I think it's about 20% of the diary there. What I tried to do was not to edit, you know, within lines here and there, not to change anything that I'd written at the time. I'd take out a chunk here and there, say, family holidays. We took out all family holidays, which I described at some length, and that helped. But what I try and do is keep each particular entry pertinent to what I was, to the pattern of the diary, because I think the diary is, although it was written just on those days, there is a kind of story in the sense there's my work, there's my family, there's, you know, all the various other elements of your life have to be there, your friends, how are you getting on with them, the pythons, whether we still see each other. So I wanted to be sure when I edited that I kept that balance of all the things that were going on in my life. But I don't change any of the lines from what they were when they were written on the day. That's very important.
Now, is that a pleasant stroll down memory lane, or is it cringeworthy reading back?
Oh, it's a bit cringeworthy sometimes. You know, you realise that you made wrong decisions or you made wrong judgments. But that's the life. It sort of brings you up, reminds you of why things went wrong and things you've done wrong. But that's the way it is. And what it does do, it's quite reassuring because it makes you aware that things don't always take a smooth course. Mm. You're very much making a very snap judgment on something and it may be the wrong one the next day. Mm. But here, you know, in the diaries, the wrong judgment is there for you to see and learn from. It's not been expunged. It's not meant, you know, it's not meant to have taken out to show that everything worked marvellously. And that's very reassuring because my life is still like that nowadays. I'm still sort of getting things wrong. And, you know, there's no magic formula. You can't say, I want my career to be this or that. And so looking back, actually, it reassures me rather more than, well, it does embarrass me every now and then.
Is Brazil going to be the last journey or are there other ones planned?
I'm pretty certain that I won't do any more long journeys. Partly because I think we've done a lot of them. I've seen a lot of the world. And I think the formula is now sort of copied by lots of other different people. And the idea of people in all walks of life, or, you know, from all areas of writing or academia or television, doing journeys around the world is now commonplace. Mm. So there are lots of people going around the world, people like Simon Reed, they're doing amazingly good stuff. And I think that the time has come for me to concentrate on a different way of travelling, which may well be just single 60-minute documentaries, rather like some of the art shows that I've done for BBC Two. And then you're not away for so long. And also, I mean, doing a journey and supplying the book that goes with it and doing the publicity is like a two-year job. And I'm now 71 and I've got grandsons and all that. I don't really want to be stuck on one project. I want to be able to do lots of different things, which I am at the moment, which is very nice.
Now, we're on RNIB's Insight Radio. Why do you support RNIB and have done for many years?
Well, I think that, you know, because you can't see, because you have problems with sight, you shouldn't be unable to read the works, all the books that are out there, and certainly the books that I've written. In fact, I love making the tapes because I think people who are unsighted can't actually, they take in more. I'm sure that they're actually listening more carefully to what you're saying. And that's great for a writer, and I think it's a great responsibility. But I think you've really got to make your writing available to everybody, There should be nobody who, just because of the way they are, aren't able to sort of access what you've said. But I do think there's a very positive thing that the blind sort of actually listen, and I've had all sorts of sort of feedback from that, saying, you know, it's very, they listen to it very carefully, and that's great.
Conscious of asking easy questions, not probing enough, being almost too respectful. Always after the interview, I think of the one question I should have asked. The silence outside on the straight, empty avenues is quite a shock after Cairo. So is the hot water, even though it's only a shower. No bath since Venice. The room is quite characterless and depressing, as is Suez. Can't wait to get on a boat tomorrow and get moving.
Michael Palin's Travelling to Work, available now in audio, and it will be available very soon from RNIB Talking Books, as are many of Michael Palin's previous travel books and his novel, The Truth. For more information, head to rnib.org.uk. And next up on today's Read On comedy special, Kim Normanton spoke to Jo Brand about her book, It's Different for Girls.
Well, it's my memoirs, which means it's basically my autobiography with lots of lies in them. Where did the idea come from? Oh, it's so tedious, but I was just asked if I would want to write it. And because it meant I could stay in a bit, I said yes.
And writing came really after you had children.
Yeah, it did. And again, that was related to some extent because when I had kids, A, I was absolutely shattered all the time. B, I didn't want to go out because I had food all down me and baby things. And so in a lot of ways, it was very convenient for me to stay at home and write rather than try and drag my tired, irritable body around the comedy clubs.
So the book that is in Talking Books is called It's Different for Girls. Tell us about that book as well.
Well, Different for Girls in some ways is a sort of evocation of my teenage years, slightly shifted in a parallel sense. So my mother doesn't know quite how awful I was. And it's set in Hastings, which is where I was a teenager. And, I mean, it's just really an attempt to kind of portray the sort of hypersensitivity that's experienced by teenagers about relationships, about their peer group, about getting older, about all those kind of very difficult things that actually are multiplied by 100 when you're a teenager, because you just really don't know who you should be and how you should be that person you want to be, really. And it's funny, hopefully.
Dealing with humour is such a wonderful release. Is that something that you use a lot in your writing? Obviously, it's your métier as a comedian, but to translate that into writing, was that really obvious?
Well, I think there's a big difference between writing in a humorous way and doing stand-up, because in stand-up you have to have roughly 4 jokes a minute or else audiences fall off to sleep or start throwing things at you. Whereas you can be a little bit more relaxed when you're writing a novel, and actually the whole sort of ethos of the book can be humorous without you actually laboriously having to write a joke per paragraph. So in some ways it's less stressful writing because the humour can come out of your characters and out of situations rather than actually having to write one-liners.
When you were younger and looking ahead to your life, did you ever think that you would have done the things that you have done?
I don't think you can ever predict how your life's going to be. You know, when I was a kid, I wanted to have 15 children and live on a farm. And I still wouldn't mind doing that, but obviously it's a bit too late for the 15 children because I'm well into my 50s now. So I think it's impossible to predict. It's something I always wanted to do, and I don't really think of myself as a person that sort of achieves everything at all costs. I just sort of forced myself initially to go on stage, and that was really hard to do, but it was certainly lubricated by a lot of alcohol the first time. And then once I'd done it once, I thought, well, I can do it again. So it's just the way it's worked out. I'm more surprised than anyone, really.
You've told us many times in your books, but can you, for our listeners, just articulate how it felt standing in front of an audience that must have just frightened the life out of you?
Well, to some extent, it felt easier than it probably did for most people because I was a psychiatric nurse for 10 years and I worked in a very kind of highly stressful department which dealt with people who are in crisis. So I had a fair bit of abuse, and may I say it was much more eloquent from psychiatric patients than it's ever been from someone in an audience. So to some extent, it didn't faze me in the way it would most people, but there is that kind of terrifying silence when you face them and you think, I've got to make them laugh. And that those few seconds before you start off is absolutely terrifying, but it's not as terrifying as working down a mine or being in a war. So it's all relative, really.
What do you think is the hardest thing that you've ever had to do?
I think probably the hardest things I've ever had to do kind of relate to having been a nurse, really. You know, having to tell people sort of unpalatable news, having to deal with people who are incredibly distressed, and also that applies to certain family things that have happened to me as well. So I would say to me, emotional things are far harder to cope with than physical things.
In the world of the blind and partially sighted, there are people who really aspire to be authors. Well, what words of encouragement would you have for someone in that situation?
Well, I would say do what you really want to do, and if it doesn't succeed, well, then at least you've tried. But I would urge anyone to try anything that they're desperate to do. And I think my advice for aspiring writers would be, try and find the voice inside you that's unique. Don't try and copy any other people's styles or be something that you don't really feel comfortable with. And I always think that ends up as a far more successful novel rather than people that admire someone and try and copy their work.
And if you were going to look back over the things that you've done and then try and predict what the next step is. I know that you're working on something for television. Do you have a clear idea of where your path is going, or is it just the next thing?
I have absolutely no idea. I just pick things randomly as they come up. You know, I wish I was organised enough to have a 10-year plan, but I'm not. I'm a very chaotic person. I just feel very thankful for what I've got and very lucky. I mean, having been a nurse for 10 years, I know what it's like to do that sort of job. So anything else is a bonus to me. So no, don't even know what's in my diary for tomorrow at the moment.
Jay, thank you very much for your time.
You're so welcome. Thanks a lot.
And finally, on this Read On Comedian special, let's talk to Phil Jupitus. We recorded this outside at the Wigtown Book Festival, possibly too close to Bill Drummond from the KLF, who was making a bed. So here's my chat with Phil Jupitus with added woodchop effects from Bill Drummond. And I started by asking Phil about the abridged audio version of his book, Good Morning Nantwich.
It's very odd to kind of read the sort of a truncated version. I would have been incredibly happy to do the whole thing, you know, because it only would have taken a few days. I just think that with books that have got that kind of singular voice to them, you do want to do it yourself. And the edit as well, you know, if they just said to me, you know, if it's very easy. I was always very good at doing pre-seeing when I was doing English language at school. So editing it down, I'd much rather have done myself, but that was sort of never an option. Whereas if they just said, right, so you've got whatever, so you've got, you know, these 10, you know, or whatever it is, 16 5,000 word chapters, and you need to take each chapter down to 2,000 words, I could have done that. but I always forget that it's out there, really. It's an odd thing, but and reading your own essays out, it felt weirdly like school again, you know, because it's the only way that I could kind of approach writing a book was to treat it like I was at school again, you know, but in a, you know, on from the more enjoyable side, and the person marking it was me, and in a way I was sort of more critical about it than I think anyone, any of the critics were, because it's weird sort of, you know, being in a position where someone will ask you to write a book just because of who you are. You're a name that they can put on the front of a book and presumably sell a few, whereas I actually had something to say about radio and the current state of radio in the UK as it was, you know, 6 years ago when the book was written. So, strange time.
Now, I know a lot of writers have really been quite angry about abridgments of their books. So, is it something that you've managed to live with now, though?
Yeah, no, it's because that's what they have to do. It's they kind of think that an audiobook, 2.5 hours, But as your listeners know, they're very happy to kind of listen to the whole thing. And it's like, I always think that, that people, particularly, I know, I mean, you being you know, associated, you know, with the blind, it's they're being deprived of a fuller version of it. And it's one of those things I'd sort of, but I think if I came back to it now, 6 years later, I'd be wanting to abridge the bugger.
Yeah. I think abridgment was so they could have two cassettes in a box.
Yeah, yeah.
Or one CD, but yeah. Because you can download them.
Well, this is it as well. And I mean the digital age, you know, means that, you know, to download the full version of a book doesn't take any time at all. I remember getting up. Sorry, we're near a wood shop.
It's Bill Drummond.
Is it Bill Drummond?
Yeah.
Oh, my God, look at him. That is the sound of Bill Drummond hammering. That is amazing. This is the best heckle I've ever had. This is not someone making a bed. This is art terrorism you're listening to there, kids. Oh, man. Anyway, so, yeah, this is fabulous. So I think that the fact that you could... I'd always wanted to kind of read the whole thing out and sort of stick it online for free somewhere anyway, but obviously, you know, HarperCollins aren't having any of that.
Now, what was your first talk on today?
We went through sort of... It was kind of, in a way, almost like my sort of Desert Island books, but it was just a look at half a dozen of my favourite books and authors, with Lee Randall, the journalist and author herself, and she's an old mate of mine, and... We've always sort of talked quite sort of impassioned terms about writers and things that we like. And I think I've got a very immediate way of expressing ideas, which is when you're a stand-up comedian, you get a very kind of unvarnished and unconsidered way of expressing your thoughts. And it's very immediate and it's very blunt from that standpoint. And so the kind of luxury of writing is something that you kind of look at with a green eye. Certainly, it's like I could never imagine what it would be like to write. And when someone writes brilliantly, like, I mean, we talked about Raymond Chandler today and Dickens and Dorothy Parker and all sorts of people, you know, A.A. Milne even, you know, who I was first introduced to as a child. They're all very, very stylish writers. You could pick a paragraph of any of those writers' work and it would be immediately recognisable as them, I feel, you know. And I suppose that's what I like, is it almost, if you read it out loud, there was a bit today, I randomly picked a paragraph of Damon Runyon and read it out, and it got a massive laugh, just because there's just, it's so evocative, you know, of that New York of the 20s, that kind of villains arena, you know, those kind of characters that he's writing about are murderers and thugs and vandals and whores and drug addicts. And he just makes them sound so affable. It's extraordinary, really. And so, yeah, I suppose the theme that I recognise by picking my writers is I like the writers that in a way are performers. You know, there's an immediacy to them. Dickens certainly used to read his stuff out to crowds. And he was almost like James Brown. He used to come off stage and claps Dickens after readings. He was quite the show queen. So yeah. I like that. I'm drawn to it. I read a little excerpt from the Pickwick Papers by Charles Dickens.
The first ray of light which illumines the gloom and converts into a dazzling brilliancy that obscurity in which the earlier history of the public career of the immortal Pickwick would appear to be involved is derived from the perusal of the following entry in the Transactions of the Pickwick Club, which the editor of these papers feels the highest pleasure in laying before his readers as a proof of the careful attention, indefatigable assiduity, and nice discrimination with which his search among the multifarious documents confided to him has been conducted. May the 12th, 1827... Joseph Smiggers, Esquire, PVPMPC, Perpetual Vice President, Member Pickwick Club, presiding. The following resolutions unanimously agreed to. That this association has heard read with feelings of unmingled satisfaction and unqualified approval the paper communicated by Samuel Pickwick, Esquire, GCMPC, General Chairman, Member Pickwick Club, entitled speculations on the source of the Hampstead ponds, with some observations on the theory of tittlebats. And that this association does hereby return its warmest thanks to the said Samuel Pickwick, Esquire, GC, MPC, for the same.
I also was looking at the collected Dorothy Parker.
She wanted to be married. She was nearing 30 now, and she did not take the years well. She spread and softened, and her darkening hair turned her to inexpert dabblings with peroxide. There were times when she had little flashes of fear about her job. And she had had a couple of thousand evenings of being a good sport among her male acquaintances. She had come to be more conscientious than spontaneous about it.
And Damon Runyon, I mean, obviously, Guys and Dolls and Other Stories was the book that we read from today. We took a little bit from.
She keeps the letters in a big inlaid box in her room, Mr. Tuesday says, and if you just pick up this box and carry it away along with the silverware, no one will ever suspect that you are after the letters, but that you take the box thinking it contains valuables. You bring the letters to me and get your 10 G's, Mr. Tuesday says, and, he says, you can keep the silverware too.
Also, in terms of more modern writers, the American poet Billy Collins, I read from his collection Aimless Love, I've got to get the order right, is it Music, 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 Clothes, 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 Boys, Boys, Boys. I think it's that order, by Viv Albertine. It may be Boys, Boys, Boys. I don't think Boys were first, I think Boys were last. It might have been Clothes, Clothes, Clothes before it was Music, Music, Music. But that book is, and you'll forgive me for saying, fantastic, fantastic, fantastic. So, yeah, it's... it was great to sort of read from that as well. And, of course, the collected sort of World of Pooh, which is the Winnie the Pooh and House at Pooh Corner collected edition. I'm still very, very fond of that book.
He hurried back to his own house, and his mind was so busy on the way with the hum that he was getting ready for Eeyore that when he suddenly saw Piglet sitting in his best armchair, he could only stand there rubbing his head and wondering whose house he was in. "Hello, Piglet," he said. "I thought you were out." "No," said Piglet. "It's you who are out, Pooh."
"As a child, how did you consume Pooh?"
a little moment there just for the listeners. how did you... My mum read it to me at first, and so this is... So I was born in 62, and so as a young child in the 60s. This is the days before... audiobooks. I mean, as a parent in the 90s, my kids had, you know, little sort of cassette players in their bedrooms and listened to audiobooks. We had the Alan Bennett Winnie the Poohs and I think one of the Willie Rushton ones as well, you know. But I never had those as a kid, not even records when they came out. You know, by the time the idea of listening to someone reading, the idea of someone else reading stories out, you know, it was... I don't remember there being albums of people reading stories out, being a very popular seller in record shops, but I think when cassettes came along and they were more portable, and then CDs, I think the rise of the audiobook in the last 20 years has been one of the most extraordinary things, you know. But although I have to say, I mustn't listen to them in cars because they're quite sort of soporific. Certainly, Philip Pullman reading his books out, I mean, they're brilliant and they're amazing, but as soon as he says Pantalaimon, I'm asleep. And he says her name quite early in that first book. And another author. I love authors when they read in their own voice. And so you can find a bit of Dorothy Parker online reading her stuff out, which is lovely. And there's a great American author who we didn't talk about today who writes really good non-fiction stuff called Sarah Vowell. And I'm sure your listeners are familiar with her because she contributes to an NPR show in America called This American Life, which is really, really good. But she has a fabulous audiobook. It's one of those ones that I listen to a lot over and over again. I'm quite drawn to it. She has a very strange quality to her voice. She was the daughter in The Incredibles, for those of you that are film-minded out there. She did the voice for her. But Sarah Vowell's book, Assassination Vacation, is absolutely brilliant. And it's a very wittily told story of... It's the story of Lincoln and Garfield and the subsequent president's assassinations, three presidential assassinations in a row that happened sort of in the 1800s and into the 20th century. And what she does is she goes on holiday looking for all the various... relics, mm-hmm. and she goes to the places where these assassinations took place. So she goes to the location of the Ford's Theatre in Washington, where Lincoln was shot, and you know, she even travels the escape route that Booth took with a broken leg up to Dr. Mudd's house. You know, when I listen to audiobooks, historical stuff fascinates me, you know, really does.
I believe it's your alter ego who's going to appear tomorrow.
Yes, indeed. No, I kind of started on my career under the name Porky the Poet in 1983. And so I started writing poetry again about 7-8 years ago. Well, kind of, I never stopped really. I got the odd commission in there, but I kind of stopped at the end of the 80s, early 90s, and then did more stand-up. But they've come back to the poetry in recent years, and it's fun to write. I've got a very singular style. But I just the bounce of words is what I like. And so, yeah, so I'm doing a Porky the Poet show tomorrow, yeah.
And going back to your early career and with the Force Awakens coming out, do you think you'll ever revive your Star Wars routine?
That's something that obviously, you know, it would be, career-wise, it would probably be the sensible thing to do, but no, I'm one of those. It's a bit like in the book talk today, I spoke about how I loved the fact that A.A. Milne could have carried on doing Winnie the Pooh stories ad infinitum, really, but he stopped after two books. But the moment Christopher Robin grew up is sort of actually chronicled, and it's so lovely that those books stop. And I think that everything has a finite span in terms of sort of ideas, and that Star Wars show was something that I wanted to do at the time. So when I started it, it was 3 or 4 gags in the middle of a 20-minute routine. Within a month, it was the whole 20 minutes. A month after that, it was 45 minutes. A year after that, it was a one-hour Edinburgh show. And then after the UK tour, and then I did 3 nights at the Lyric in Hammersmith, it was longer than the film. And that, to me, was kind of, you know what? You've said everything. Now it's longer than the film. I think you're done. Because I only talked about the first original, the film everyone calls Star Wars, which the nerds call A New Hope. That episode 4, that's what I talk about, is just that one, because that to me was the most, it's a story. And we know it's a story because it's the Searchers. It's the Searchers redone in space is what it is. So yeah.
Thanks once again to Phil Jupitus and all the comedians who appeared on today's show. I'll be back at the same time next week with more book news, reviews and author interviews. And remember, you can join me every day of the week on Talking Books. First at 7 in the morning, then there's a different tale on at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. I can be found on Twitter at @talking_books. So farewell until next week, and remember to read on.